The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Elaine Graham Lee is the guest this week. She's a member of Counterfire and a former member of the steering committee of the Campaign Against Climate Change. And it's in the upper 90s here in Portland, so I wish that that steering committee had done better work. Her book at Zero Books was called A Diet of Austerity. It's still available. It was published in April of this year. Jonathan Neal, author of Stop Global Warming, Change the World, blurbed Elaine Graham Lee's book as follows. He said, "Who is to blame for climate change? Graham Lee says it's not fat people, cows, or the working class. A challenging and interesting book, packed with new ideas to make you think again about what you thought you knew." It's Wednesday, July 1st, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear clips from a news report about Belgian blue cows, a cow saying moo, dueling banjos from the film Deliverance, Brendan Cooney explaining socially necessary labor time, a nutritious breakfast torture collage, an instrumental cover of the protest standard We Shall Overcome, and an audio collage built on advertisements from the 70s. The music you're listening to right now is Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs. But in just a moment, you'll hear Elaine Graham Lee and I discuss A Diet of Austerity. Elaine Graham Lee is a member of Counterfire and a former member of the steering committee of the Campaign Against Climate Change. Her book, A Diet of Austerity, came out from Zero Books in April, and it has a different take on the connection between agriculture and climate change than the one you've usually heard. Elaine Graham Lee, welcome to Zero Squared.
Thank you.
So, quickly, if you can, summarize what you think the usual take on climate change is as it relates to, say, working class people or just everyday people, and what your book is arguing.
Sure. Well, what I'm arguing against is an idea about how we deal with climate change that's about saying that it's up to individuals to change their own lifestyles. So this is quite a common argument that you get in climate change circles, particularly actually with the failure of, sort of the talks at Copenhagen and so on, that people sort of despair of government action. So they say, well, actually, all we can do is encourage individuals to change what they do. And the problem is that then becomes an argument that it's individuals' fault that we have climate change. And it does seem to, and it's in many areas, not just actually in connection with food, it becomes an argument that actually, well, middle class people who shop in the farmers markets and eat organic and so on, well, they're fine, they're taking care of their emissions. It's those working class people who don't know about this stuff who are the problem. So where I was starting, my starting off point from the book was looking at that argument in connection with food, and so I'm looking specifically how those connections are made in the kind of what I think of as a sort of fairly mainstream argument between working class consumption and climate change, and arguing that, well, actually it's not about working class people's behaviour, working class people's existence. It is actually a systemic problem. So.
Are you familiar with a man named Dmitry Orlov? Have you ever heard of him? He's an American phenomenon, I think, and not a huge one. But he wrote a book called Reinventing Collapse, and he runs a blog about organic farming and alternative lifestyles. He lives on a boat like a sailboat, then he has it all decked out with like solar panels and, you know, compost and I don't know, all that kind of stuff. And I lifted a little quote from his blog, and I just thought I'd read it to you and get your reaction to it, because I think he summarizes a certain kind of attitude about the situation today. It says, the USA, he's talking about America, of course, to start with. The USA is best characterized as a decomposing corpse of a nation lorded over by a tiny clique of oligarchs who control the herd by wielding Orwellian methods of mind control. This is good stuff. So far gone is the populace that most of them think that things are just peachy. There's an economic recovery, don't you know? But a few of them do realize that they have lots of personal issues with things like violence, drugs, alcohol abuse, and gluttony. And then he says, what we're looking at is human-triggered extinction episode that will certainly be beyond anything in human experience, and which may rival the great Permian-Triassic extinction event of 252 million years ago. So anyway, I summarized it, but he goes on and on blaming the consumers, basically, for this this tragedy that's unfolding in the environmental realm. So,
yeah. Well, I think that's quite common. That it puts the blame on individuals, and therefore, you know, it must be that individuals are selfish and lazy and stupid and all of these things. That it's somehow their fault that they don't change their behaviour. And I think, you know, I don't want to come over as slacking off everyone who has a sort of alternative lifestyle or lives in a sheep farm in Wales or on a boat or wherever. But you do sometimes get that attitude that people think, well, I've withdrawn from society, so why can't everybody? Without, I think, appreciating that it's really not possible for everyone to all live on a sheep farm in Wales because there's not enough room. We do have to find systemic solutions to these things. These kind of, you know, well, everyone can just go off grid. It's not realistic. But I think that's often where a lot of these sort of theories are coming from, and I don't think it's very helpful.
You really examine the data about agriculture and the way food is produced in terms of how that production influences the environment and to what degree it's responsible for our the way we do agriculture is responsible for climate change. Could you talk a little bit about the realities of that and what you've found?
The arguments about the influence of food on climate change really start with a report that the UN did in 2006 called Livestock's Long Shadow. And that estimated that sort of agriculture, well, meat production, so, you know, sort of cows and sheep and things, were responsible for up to sort of 13% of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's been refined by a number of different reports. So some reports come and estimate that it's about 20% of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a huge number. That's more than transport. So that the headlines when these reports come out is always, it's worse to eat meat than to drive a car. And what I was looking at in the book was, well, you know, how realistic is that, and is it reasonable to decide that therefore what we do about this is to just eschew certain sorts of food as opposed to looking at the systems of how they're produced and so on. So that's what quite a lot of the sort of the detailed statistical work in the book was about. And a lot of these estimates are, to be honest, rather back of a fag packet stuff. It's quite surprising when people talk about greenhouse gas emissions with, you know, amazing precision and, you know, we know this. It's all estimates. And a lot of these estimates about greenhouse gas emissions from dairy farming, for example, are rather dubious at best. For example, sort of figures about water use for, you know, cattle farming. Some of them include all the rain that falls on the land that the cows are in as water consumption by the cows, which is clearly dubious. You know, this is a way of saying, and they use this much water and it's killing the plant and therefore we must kill all the cows. And it's really kind of dodgy, a lot of these statistics.
Well, I want to say in their defense that some of those people probably wouldn't advocate that we kill all the cows. After all, that's what we're doing now. Maybe free them or something. But in any case...
You do have to not have the cows. Well, probably you have them by not having them be born in the first place, but definitely fewer cows is very much part of this because they fart methane, you see, so you can't have them.
Oh, that's true. If you let them free, a good portion of them would take care of themselves and die off and pretty yeah. quickly. And then there would be a sustainable level of cows or something.
Yeah.
But you're quite right. They do have to die. And without reproducing, that's the key.
This cow is technically known as a Belgian Blue, and it's the product of selective breeding.
Selective breeding is the first stop on our tour of how man is using science to control nature. It's used by farmers to enhance desirable characteristics in their animals. In fact, selective breeding...
The numbers about meat production are then kind of shifted over in people's minds to being about human consumption. In other words, that we blame just the fact that so many people are around wanting to eat for climate change almost propose, you know, mass starvation as a cure-all for the environmental problems we're having. I mean, it's almost that drastic sometimes, especially with people like Dmitry Orlov. But how does that shift happen, and what's the reality about overall agricultural production and its influence on the environment? What are those numbers actually like?
The reason why it becomes an argument about what people shouldn't really exist at all, in a sense, I mean, that's a Malthusian argument. And of course, Malthus, at the beginning of the 19th century, argued that that the working classes would outbreed their resources and therefore they would starve because they would just carry on having too many children that they wouldn't be able to feed. And so I think a lot of these arguments do kind of resonate with people who are part of the sort of movement that thinks that population is an issue and that therefore we have to reduce population and so on. So it kind of feeds into that whole Malthusian thinking. I think more broadly, food has become kind of part of the thinking about overconsumption. That, you know, people have been saying since the Second World War that our consumption is what is killing the planet and it's bad for society and so on. And what I traced in the book is how overconsumption, the definition of what overconsumption is, has changed from being consumption of consumer goods and quite high-end consumer goods to consumption about food, kind of pretty much, you know, without exception. That now pretty much all the authors about overconsumption are really talking about food more than anything else. And that's kind of come to stand for everything wrong that modern consumer society is doing to the planet. And become therefore about fat people killing the planet, because obviously who is overconsuming? Well, you can see by looking at them, it's fat people. It's kind of the argument, which doesn't make a lot of sense. It doesn't even make a lot of sense to conflate meat eating with overeating. I mean, people who follow the Atkins diet would tell you that it's kind of the opposite. So it doesn't actually hang together very logically. But I think that's the steps of how the argument gets to, okay, it's working class people destroying the world. The reality of agriculture's influence on the planet is very different. I mean, I'm not saying that modern capitalist agriculture is absolutely unproblematic, because it's clearly not. But there are quite a lot of often quite technical things that can be done to really ameliorate that. So, I mentioned cows fart methane, and methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. Well, you can change the way that you feed cows. You can change the composition of the cattle cake, and that actually means that they produce much less methane. So there's kind of there's lots of things that are being tried for how you actually get a more responsible agriculture, and how you can do these things and not actually destroy the planet at the same time. And it's reasonably promising. I mean, I think in a way the technical ways you change how you feed cows are, I think, the most interesting aspect of this debate. But it's not the case that we're inescapably locked into this, and the only thing you can do is by removing all cattle from the planet, because actually that's not the case.
What are some of the barriers to making the kinds of changes that need to take place systemically, like in the way that we feed cows, that might reduce the greenhouse gases that are emitted from that process? Why aren't those technical fixes being implemented, do you think?
I think it's absolutely profit. That, you know, there's at the moment, there's, if you're in a market system, there's not really any impetus to say, well, actually, you'll make more, you know, you should do what's for the good of the planet, even if it won't mean that you make more money out of it.
So this makes it a more expensive process to change the way they feed the cows.
As far as I know, it doesn't necessarily. And I have to admit, I'm not an absolute expert in exactly what you would have to pay to change the composition of the cattle cake and so on. But it is interesting that more widely, experiments in sort of sustainable agriculture are often happening in places like, say, in Venezuela, where it's not really quite a market system. And I think that tells you what the barriers are to finding a sustainable agriculture that still produces food that people actually want to, you know, that people want to eat and can feed everybody. I think the default setting, if you're thinking within a market system, is to think, well, actually, we can't feed everybody, or we can only just feed everybody, so everyone has to have a restricted standard of living so that no one absolutely starves. And I think that's an assumption looking at things purely from within the market. And if you were able to kind of remove the market, actually the conclusions you would come to about whether we can feed everybody would be very different.
What are the numbers on the technical difficulties of feeding the population right now? I mean, right now, my understanding is that we produce more than enough food to feed everyone.
Yeah, we do. And I think there's an assumption. I mean, you've probably come across the argument of kind of the billion versus the billion. I mean, this is kind of a trope that people say. I mean, it's of Raj Patel, Stuffed and Starved, says this, but lots of writers do. That, you know, there's a billion people in the world that are malnourished and a billion people that are obese. And this is kind of, there's somehow a causal relationship with the two things.
Right, right.
So it's the kind of idea that if you could just take some food off the fatties and then give it to the people who are malnourished, then that would be fine. But within that, there's an assumption that actually we only just have enough food. So you're sharing around scarcity, and you're kind of managing scarcity more reasonably. And part of that is thinking that, well, actually, because we have to respond to climate change, we can't expand food production. You know, we can't cut down the rainforest to grow crops on it, because actually that's really bad for the environment, which is, of course, true. So it's the idea that what we're doing is managing really quite severe scarcity. I think that that's true if you're looking at it within the capitalist system of agricultural production. I don't think that we actually have any figures at all on whether that would still be true if we were able to organise production slightly more rationally.
That should really be looked into, and I'm sure there are people who are trying to discover how to be more rational in the way that they produce food. And I think that, not to be an advocate for capitalism here, because I'm not, but I think that it's even conceivable that more rational agricultural production that has less environmental impact would be something that could fit into a capitalist world, at least the technical side of it. I mean, what are the technical limits to the market economy here? Again, I just have to ask, what, other than the added expense, what do you think that, is it just that the capitalist form is slow to move? You have these industry standards that are proven to be profitable, and people aren't going to change for any reason other than increasing profits, and that's why these changes aren't implemented, or what do you
think? I think it's partly that. It's partly that, so having different stages in production adds surplus value, so it adds profit. So John Bellamy Foster has this very good example of the number of steps to make a muffin, like a cake. If you're making a cake at home in your kitchen, it's what, sort of five, you have sort of five ingredients and you have maybe three steps to mix up the batter and put it in the oven and so on, and it's very simple. He traced an actual sort of a muffin that was made sort of commercially to be sort of wrapped in plastic and sold in the shop, and I can't remember precisely how many steps there were, but it was something like 15 or 20. The thing to understand, I think, is that each of these steps is a process of adding, this adds value. So this is a company, and it's not the same company all the way through, making money out of making this cake. So there's an impetus in capitalism to add more and more steps rather than have fewer and fewer, because that's where you make your money. More highly processed goods have more surplus value and more profit than less processed goods, very broadly speaking. So the impetus within capitalism is to always make things more processed and more complicated, because that's what you make your money out of. So it's very difficult to kind of step back from that and say, well, actually, yes, we would make more money if we added an extra processing step here, and therefore we can charge more for this, but we won't because it's bad for the environment. I mean, no businesses do that. The structure of businesses mean that they're not allowed to do that because they have to maximize shareholder profit.
Right. Well, you know, I've been reading Capital. I don't know if you're aware, but I've been running a Zero Books Marxist Capital Reading Group. And the thing about adding value to a commodity through labor is that it's true that the source of value in a commodity is the labor time. But at the same time, the capitalist wants to expend as little labor time on each commodity as possible in order to be able to undersell slightly his competition. That's why you have innovation in production. So in actual fact, the amount of labor time spent on a muffin when it's mass produced as compared to when it's made, in a simple one-step process is probably less, because you've got a mechanized process that so per muffin, you have actually less labor time involved, actual human labor time. Go ahead.
Oh yes, but adding the processes, even if they're mechanized, is where the firms that are doing those processes are making money. So really, there's no interest in going back to it's a completely simple process. So it's five steps from thinking I'll have a cake to you have a cake. No one's making money out of that.
My instinct is that the extra steps are necessary in terms of distribution, and also necessary in terms of when you have a mass production line going, you need extra steps to handle just the volume that you're producing. So it produces more steps in the production of a muffin than you would have if it was a mom and pop, little bakery, because you're shipping it, you're producing so much that it requires lots of extra steps. But I just know that the per muffin, the bakery is spending more time on producing it, even with the extra steps.
Alone on his tropical island, Robinson Crusoe can take as long as he wants to build a cabin for himself. It's up to him. We don't have that luxury when we produce for market exchange. When Wonder Bread makes bread, they're competing in the market against Pepperidge Farm, Arnold, and White Rose. If their workers are less productive, if they take longer to make bread, that doesn't mean that they can sell their bread for more money. The social value of bread is not set by individuals, but by the average amount of time it takes to produce bread. This is called the socially necessary labor time. Let's say the average television takes 1 hour to make. 1 hour is the socially necessary labor time for televisions. But the owner of the Acme TV factory invests in some fancy new machines that make his workers twice as productive. They can now make a television in 30 minutes. They are producing way below the socially necessary labor time. This allows Acme to produce twice as many televisions in the same amount of time. Now, if Acme sold their new TV at half the old price, they wouldn't make any more money than before, and there would have been no point in investing in all of that new stuff. Rather than selling them at their individual value of 30 minutes, they continue to sell them at their socially necessary labor time of 1 hour, or perhaps just under the socially necessary labor time, in order to outsell their rivals. Because the price of TVs hasn't changed significantly, there's still the same demand from consumers for TVs. But now there is a giant surplus of TVs on the market because Acme has been making twice as many TVs. Acme's rivals won't be able to sell all of their TVs. Part of their product will go unsold. Meanwhile, Acme will sell most of their TVs at the socially necessary labor time, making not just their normal profit, but an additional super profit, because they've sold their TVs above their individual values by selling at or near the socially necessary labor time.
But overall, what we'll agree on is that this mode of production requires a certain approach and has its own rationality when it comes to food production, and that we might have better options available to be more environmentally conscious if we produce food a different way.
Yes, and I think also it's I haven't been able to find, I looked quite hard, any estimates for how much land there is on the planet that you could potentially use for agriculture. There are lots of estimates of how much agricultural land there is on the planet. There are some estimates of land that isn't being used at all that you could potentially use for agriculture. What there isn't is anyone sitting down and saying, right, okay, if we didn't necessarily have all of these golf courses, for example, if we wanted to say, well, actually, you're not allowed to have an enormous private estate that you just keep with lawns because that's what you like. If you looked at all the surface area of the planet and you assessed actually how much of this you could use to grow food on, if you had a different social system that removed all of those uses of land that we might think wasn't very useful, how much food production land would we have? And as far as I know, that figure doesn't exist, but that's the really important figure, because that tells you how many people, ultimately, we could support on the planet under a different social system. The only figures we have are how many people can we feed under capitalism, which, because then it locks in certain land uses and so on, isn't necessarily the only system we will ever have. And using those figures to say, well, we will never, ever be able to feed more than X billion number of people, I think isn't, you know, that's not accurate in a sense, because if you had completely different ways of looking at land use, you could potentially feed quite a lot more people, I think. But like I say, I mean,
that's speculative, but yeah. But I mean, you're talking about golf. No, I'm sorry. I don't golf.
Golf is an example. I'm not just coming to the golf.
You know, you'll take my golf clubs away, you know, out of my cold, dead hands. No, I'm not
perhaps being entirely serious, but that's my point, that I think, you know, what we're talking about is how well capitalism fits on the planet. And most arguments around this, I think, take that to be the same as how humanity fits on the planet. And what I'm arguing is that these actually aren't synonymous. And if we conclude that, well, capitalism doesn't fit on the planet very well, the answer to that is not to conclude that we have too many people. The answer is to think, well, maybe this system isn't actually the cleanest and least wasteful system that we can possibly have for feeding everybody.
What is the percentage of greenhouse gases that are emitted from agriculture overall?
There are various different estimates. It's the highest of around 20% for food production. The lower ones are more around sort of 12 to 13. So there's a range, but it's kind of that sort of range. And it really does depend on what you include and how you calculate it, but that's the sort of order that you're talking.
And to what extent are the other culprits here intertwined with food production? I mean, like transportation, if you separate that out from food production, it's not really fair because the food has to be transported, right? So does that figure include that some segment of transportation emissions that is involved in agriculture, or is it only methane and the actual growing of crops that are included?
Some do and some don't, which again is why the figures are all very approximate, because yeah, some, and I told you the example about the assessing the water use for for cattle as being all the rain that falls on the land that cattle sometimes graze on. So sometimes when you really unpick these figures, it's not, you can think, well, that's not necessarily fair. And indeed, yeah, some of these figures do include transport, which, as you say, is kind of slightly different from just absolutely how much emissions do cows cause, you know. I mean, it's interestingly, I mean, until sort of about 10 years ago, the focus of emissions from food was very much on the sort of transport and distribution and that kind of end stuff. It was kind of all the sort of food miles arguments and things. And that was very much an anti-globalisation argument that was really quite political. The focus has now changed to the sort of inherent emissions to certain sorts of food, particularly meat, which has really made it a much less political argument. In a sense that you can have discussions about, well, maybe you might have a different system for food distribution that would reduce emissions, but if the emissions are just because of the essential biological nature of a cow, well, a cow is going to have that nature regardless what system it's existing in. So it kind of, the shift from one to the emphasizing from one to the other was such a marked political one. I'm not sure that it's just led by sort of advances in the science of understanding food's contributions. I suspect that this is actually a political change in how we think about
the big vegan lobby that's controlling our discourse. it's the hippie vegans, and the hipster vegans are manipulating the data. One thing I really like about what you're saying is that turning to look at the system in a rational way is going to be the best approach. It seems like we're always looking to find the culprit, the human actors that are uniquely responsible for the problem. Like, you know, the problem is fat people, or the problem is poor people, or the problem, even if it's rich golfers, we're always looking for some group to blame rather than say, look, the problem is all of these people in this system as it's set up now. And just one segment of it isn't, you can't just blame one segment of it and think that it's going to go away. It's all the segments are interconnected.
Yeah, and I think also you can't have a view of a system that just says, well, when you're talking about food, that the reason why the food system is like it is a kind of an aggregation of all the desires of the fat people and the working class people and the rich golfers and so on. It's actually the idea that the food system works in the way it does because that's what we want is, I think, erroneous. The idea that it's led by consumer demand is not true. And actually, when you look at sort of major shifts in sort of populations' diets in the last century, it's always actually been led by the producers and kind of, in a sense, enforced on people. The reason why Americans eat so much beef is because beef producers decided to make them eat more beef and put an awful lot of effort into replacing pork with beef. So it's kind of the idea that people have the diets that they do because that's what they want to eat, and what you have to change is their minds is not correct, I don't think. And the idea that the system just exists to facilitate because of their desires is also not correct. It's really the other way around.
The idea that we can change people's consumption patterns just by putting out pamphlets or something is kind of crazy, right? I mean, if you just tell people to stop eating beef enough, you know, they'll stop. That's just not true. You have to change the way the things are produced and what kind of food is available to people.
One other thing that, you know, particularly working class people get very criticized for, you know, over here for sort of eating crap, eating junk food, eating processed food. And those criticisms don't take into account anything about the circumstances that people live in that might mean that they can't spend 3 hours every evening making a delicious stew with cheap, fresh vegetables that they bought from their farmer's market. That actually this expectation that people should just do this because it's the best thing to do really isn't realistic when you think about the realities of how people live. And I don't know what it's like in Portland, but certainly in London, I know from, you know, many times looking for new places to live, and you go around sort of very, you know, very small cheap flats, that's all that most people can afford, in kind of crappy areas of London, and often they don't even have kitchens, they don't have cookers, you know. So the idea that, oh, you know, poor people are at fault because they're not understanding that they would be so much healthier if they just cooked from scratch properly, doesn't understand that, well, lots of people don't have the facilities to do that. So it's really kind of blaming people for things that really aren't in their control.
Portland is like a farmer's market and, you know, small local food kind of utopia. The downside is everyone has to have their own goat. So it's there by law. And that's a problem. And you know, there's so many chickens running around.
That isn't actually a bylaw, huh?
Yeah, so, yeah. It used to be you have to have a cat, but now the new law is you have to have some sort of farmyard animal in your backyard, or if you're in an apartment, in one of the rooms. And usually it's a goat. But no, there really is in Portland a very distinct ethic of personal choice and you know, your consumption habits being your politics. I mean, everyone doesn't think that way, but if you are really concerned about the world, you're going to make sure that you eat a very nutritious breakfast.
Uh-oh, Lucky needs your help. You can find out how on boxes of Swirled Up Lucky Charms, part of this nutritious breakfast.
Get me down!
Part of this nutritious breakfast. 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 Nutritious breakfast.
Yes, I encountered this many years ago when I was first in the Green Party over here. And I used to get the bus to meetings because they were about 4 miles away from where I lived. And then on the way back after the meeting, I used to get some chips from the independent chippy. And eat them waiting for the bus because I usually had to wait about half an hour for the bus and it was cold and I was hungry, so I'd stand there eating chips. And the other people in the Green Party really disapproved of this on just a kind of a moral level, that this was just really not appropriate for a Green to do. And I could not work out what the objection was. It's like these things were wrapped in paper, which I would recycle on the way home, and it was an independent shop, and I was taking public transport, for heaven's sake.
Right.
But somehow it was not being green because it was, I don't know, fattening food.
It was greasy.
So it's this conflation, as you say, with politics and morality around personal consumption is really, really not helpful.
You know, it's also not green to wear clothes that are unfashionable or out of date. You know, polyester, for instance. That's all right. That's not green. It's silly. It's a lifestyle replacing politics. And so why don't you tell me about what you think about human population and how it fits into this overall kind of let's blame the poor approach to politics.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I think the population argument is really quite pernicious in green circles, I think, and it always comes up. I mean, whenever you have an article in any sort of media over here about anything to do with climate change, you know, kind of regardless of what angle it takes, there's always somebody who will put in the comment, yes, but what about population? That's the key issue. And it's particularly bad, I think, when it gets linked to immigration stuff, which actually I think is more something that the American sort of population movement does than the British one, where it's arguing that it's okay if people exist in the third world, but what's absolutely key is we have to stop them from coming over here because they will have much greater per head climate, you know, greenhouse gas emissions if they come to the first world. So it's kind of gets, so an argument that you would think people, you know, that's coming from a concern about climate change, which is kind of conceived as a left-wing thing, then marries up with actually extreme right-wing. So it's kind of, you know, supporting for patrolling the Mexican border with guns kind of thing. And I think a lot of the food arguments are effectively Malthusian arguments. So some are explicitly Malthusian, some are implicitly Malthusian. But all of them are basically saying, well, it's you know, working class people's consumption of food is the problem. Well, working class people's existence is therefore the problem. Which I think is, you know, it's a really troubling place for this argument to end up. And I think it shows actually, you know, this is one of the reasons why we really have to resist this argument that it's all about how much you eat. And, you know, you can tell how much someone eats by what class they are or how fat they are or whatever. And it really does end up in that place where you're saying, well, actually, people don't really have the right to exist if they're poor. Which is kind of, you know, from a social justice point of view, is really, really troubling.
So what's wrong with that argument that we should keep, I mean, other than the morality of it and the politics of it, is that argument that immigrating people, that basically as the first world's population grows, that's going to have a deleterious effect on the environment, is that wrong?
Well, it's assuming that the first world has a deleterious effect on the environment because of the number of people that it has, and that its effect will go up, you know, in accordance with how much population it is, which I think is not true. I mean, that's not really how systemic effect on climate change works. It's not true that greenhouse, you know, you can come up with a figure for greenhouse emissions, greenhouse gas emissions per head in different societies across the world, but it's not true that it starts with the individual and then is scaled up to the country. You know, it's a system that produces greenhouse gas emissions, and you can then divide that by the number of people to get the greenhouse gas per head. But it's not true that adding two more heads would increase the emissions by two, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I think that's a faulty way of looking at it. And it's also, again, it's missing the point that if you change the system, you could change the emissions. It's not about how many people you've got, and it's certainly not about how many poor people you've got. It's basically, you have a system that exists by creating huge disparities of wealth between the richest and the poorest people, and then blaming the poorest people for all the emissions that are caused by the system that actually they're exploited by and don't benefit from, which is not, you know, it's not true. It's not the case that that poor people's consumption is what's destroying the world. That's just an incorrect way of seeing the world. And as we've already touched on, it isn't the case that we've just got too many people on the planet to be able to feed them all, which is where that argument ultimately ends up.
It's amazing to me that this is considered a left position by anyone, in some ways, environmentalism is an uneasy fit. It doesn't really fit with the left project overall. If you consider environmentalism to always hold to the idea that what the system we have now is natural, you know, that we can't change our political and economic system, so everything has to be done to protect nature within this system. That can never be really a left project.
I think that's true. And I think particularly when it's seen as protecting nature from people. I mean, I was really struck reading some mostly American sort of Malthusian arguments, how much they go on about national parks and how it's terrible how national parks are really crowded on holidays and how this must, you know, they have to be kept pristine so that people who can really appreciate them can go to them and, you know, put up with all these other people in there. It can't seem to me, this isn't a climate change argument. This is a working class people being admitted to privileges like being able to go on a day trip that previously only rather wealthier people had, and those rather wealthier people rather resenting the working class people being in their sort of privileged spaces, it seemed to me. Which again, I mean, some arguments about immigration often talk about, oh, it's just too crowded, like there's physically too many people, it will be too busy. And that is, again, that's very much kind of, you know, middle class, upper class privilege, saying we don't want more smelly working class people in our space physically. nothing to do with how much space there is on the planet. It's a completely ridiculous argument.
Right. You know, it can even get to a point where with people in Portland that I've, like friends of mine, that when I'm talking about the environment with them, they'll say things like, well, luckily, you know, one day the human race will wipe itself out and the Earth will recover once we're all gone. It's not even like it's health in this kind of what I think of as a healthy misanthropy where other people are to be despised just on principle. I can kind of understand that if you're honest about it. Like, I like the national parks to be empty because I don't like people and I want them out of my way. Well, okay, I understand that. That's not a politics. That's not a political position. That's just you being a grumpy, you know, old cuss or something. It's not, that's not anything to hold on to, like, or build, like, write on a sign and march around. No, but it's respectable. You don't like people. I don't blame you. But this, when it gets to the point where I'm looking forward to the death of the species, so that, I mean, at that point I say, well, what's the difference between that and just, if you really want a cleaned up planet, I think maybe the best way to go about it is to wipe out all life on the planet, because, you know, at that point, no one would mess anything up. There would never be any problems. It would all be pristine and the same.
Yes, and of course, it's not understanding how much of what we think is natural is actually created by human society. I mean, you know, if humans weren't on the planet, it wouldn't be that you would have sort of, you know, beautiful flower meadows with lambs gambolling around and things. I mean, it would all be covered in trees, actually, and only the species that could live with that would survive. So, you know, the idea that it would somehow be perfect if it wasn't just for the pesky humans just really doesn't understand the history of, evolution of species on this planet. This is not to say that human society doesn't cause problems, because of course it does, but it's a completely ridiculous view of how humans interact with nature, and seeing that humans and nature are separate, whereas of course we are animals, we're part of the existence, we're not separate from it.
It also underestimates how, you know, noxious and troublesome all the other species on the planet are, you know. It's not like we've got this, everyone, it's not like all the other species are in this perfect balance worked out, you know, exactly how it should be. You know, nature is a brutal nightmare.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love.
Oh, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country.
I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
Some people don't.
Raid!
Yes, Raid, house and garden bug killer. For both indoors and outdoors. Raid hunts bugs down like radar.
And keep it company.
To create Horrifying Planet, our camera crews filmed many repulsive and offensive things no one had seen before, many of which are now being driven to annihilation by humankind's encroachment. But how do we hasten this process? There is no simple answer. But here's one way we can all do our part: by dumping bleach everywhere.
And keep it company.
Well, it's interesting that you haven't talked about the connection between sort of working class people and fatness at all, because that's usually something that people pick me up on and say, oh, you know, how can you conflate these two? How can you say that, you know, how can you go from talking about obesity to talking about working class people? And I have to kind of work hard to defend that connection.
there have been studies on this, right? I mean, it's not...
I mean, there's a connection at a population level between areas that have, you know, high levels of poverty and areas that have high levels of obesity. So it's not like there's a, you can say, okay, this person is fat because they're working class, but at a population level, there's a correlation. But more actually, it's that there's a correlation in people's minds. I mean, this is where I sat and looked at, looked at all the images to use to illustrate obesity on the BBC website and things, just to sort of see, well, actually, you know, how are we being told to think about the class identification of obesity? And it was overwhelmingly, really clearly images that you're supposed to identify as working class people. You know, when it wasn't kind of a naked midriff, which obviously has no class identifier at all, but anything that showed people in a class context, it was all people wearing scruffy clothes, carrying carrier bags in sort of clearly working class settings, like building sites or sort of greasy spoon cafes or something like that. What you never ever had was pictures of, you know, sort of bankers eating in high end restaurants. Which, considering that I did this exercise first in 2008 and then I repeated it a few years later, so considering those were the years of the financial crash, the fact that you didn't get any news stories about obesity illustrated with pictures of bankers overdoing it was really quite surprising, because you would have thought that that would be a visual story that you could tell, but no one ever does, because obesity is working class, and that's how it's, you know, that's how it's identified. So, you know, stories about, oh, fat people destroying the planet means working class people are destroying the planet. That's what you're supposed to understand by that. So I think that's quite important for kind of decoding this stuff.